Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to thank and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Room by Room, the Home Organization Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We're champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Gabriella Yastra, coming to you from NAM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's begin. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to be navigating housing styles for your dream home with Tarek Mubayed, who is an architect at ACOM. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gabriella.
So we get to know you a bit better. Do you mind introducing yourself? Tell us a bit about who you are.
Okay. So my name is Tarek Mubayed. I'm an architect at AECOM, as you mentioned, Gabriella. I've been living in Houston, Texas for the past 2.5 years now, but I used to live actually in Lebanon, which is a small country in the Middle East, for people who don't know. So most of my background was actually living there, studying there. I got my bachelor's in architecture in Lebanon. And then I moved to the U.S. like at the end of COVID, which was very fun. So I moved to the U.S. and I started my master's and I graduated. And then here I am now talking to you.
Yeah, great. So yes, quite a bit of a journey between Lebanon and the U.S., I'm sure. Thank you so much. We're going to do a section we call Have You Met Tarek, where we get to know you through some of your favorite things. So the first thing we'd like to know is, what is your favorite book?
So my favorite book, I had to do some digging, but I remember that my favorite book is called The Swiss Family Robinson. I don't think it's a very popular book. I don't know who knows it and who doesn't, but I actually have it here. And so this is the book. And for people who can't really see if they're just listening, it's basically a book about this family that gets stranded on an island. Their ship gets wrecked and then they have to build their own life, you know, like build their own treehouse. And then they have to figure out all these different things to set up their new life, you know, because they don't know when someone's going to come save them. And so it's kind of interesting. It's kind of maybe related to our topic, you know, how you set up your life and your environment. How do you organize the space to suit you? So I found it a very interesting book.
I'm surprised I haven't read it because one of my favorite books was an Enid Blyton book where they have the same thing, like a bunch of kids run away from home and they go to an island and they like set up a home and they like steal a cow so they can have milk.
No, it's pretty, I haven't read that book, but now I think I should read the book you're talking about. Get the book I suggest.
We'll swap book recommendations. What was the book I was reading? It was like something go to a secret island or I'll find it and I will post it in the show notes. I'll tell you. But yeah. Okay. So it sounds like I need to read Swiss Family Robinson.
It's a good book, you know, because one of the things I think we'll touch on is like how different people have different needs in the space that they live in. And so like, cause it's a whole family. So there's the kids, there's the parents, and then sometimes you get all these fresh new ideas from the kids that the parents are like, what's going on? But then they find that, well, this was a good idea. Like, why didn't we take this into consideration? So it shows how like all different people have different ideas and somehow everyone makes it work.
Okay, that sounds great. And I love how, you know, initially maybe it doesn't seem like it's connected to our topic, but it is. It's amazing. And have you watched any movies recently that you enjoyed?
Well, probably like everyone, I've watched Barbie. but yeah, Barbie was a good movie.
What did you like about it?
Well, I think first of all, it was kind of, you know, a lot of people criticized the beginning of it and so on, but I like that it was kind of revolutionary in many ways. And it was kind of a movie that makes you think a lot, but it also has a light tone to it. So it's not overly, you know, selling an idea without it being light and humorous. But It was a really good movie. And I like Margot Robbie. I like, you know, the whole
The whole cast was great. And of course, Margot Robbie, who I believe is from Melbourne, I think.
Yeah, I think
At least Australia. And what about any podcasts?
So I listened to 99 PI. And actually, like yesterday, so it's a good podcast. It's they talk a lot about architecture, and sometimes they tie different topics in a very interesting way to the built environment. I started maybe a year ago, but something that I got hooked on yesterday was a true crime podcast, because I don't know if you've watched Only Murders in the Building.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started, I was like, let me see, like, what, maybe true crime podcasts are good. And yeah, I watched like 4 episodes today at work. But it was good. It was good.
Which podcast is it?
It's called, well, this one is kind of a heavy one, but it's called, what's it called? It's about basically this, it's a scandal that happened at Yale Hospital in Connecticut, where there was a nurse stealing fentanyl. It's kind of dark, but it's a true story. And it was at an IVF clinic, so she was stealing the anesthetic that was meant for patients. I'll pull up the name later and I'll share it with you.
Yeah, thank you.
But yeah, I was like, I had to know how it ended, so I had to like listen to it throughout work.
Yeah, yes. I think I've actually heard news stories about it, like not the podcast, but like other podcasts talking about this podcast. And it's just terrible, the idea that, you know, these women are going through these very painful procedures, being told that they're under anesthetic, or, you know, they shouldn't feel anything. And actually, it's just saline.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And the harder part is, like, you know, the women are experiencing this and people are like, you shouldn't be experiencing this. Mm. And then if you did, it's probably like there's something wrong with your body, or there's something, you know, like they blame the victim. It was like, I was like half the time I'm like trying to hold in like my shock, because I was surprised at several portions of what I heard. But yeah, it was a very good podcast.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you for that recommendation. Do you have a role model?
So I thought about this a lot, and a lot of the times whenever someone asks me, I usually say it's my dad. And the reason I say it's my dad is because of the way he lives his life, which is, you know, regardless of the problems that come his way, he finds a way to just, you know, like enjoy the moment. Like, you know, like it's a problem today and we're going to solve it. We're going to figure out the solution. I'm an overthinker, so to me that system doesn't work. But to him, it's like, you know what, like, let me enjoy this moment and then I'll solve the problem. Or, you know, like there's no reason to be on panic mode, which is the mode that I'm always on. Like, he's on airplane mode, I'm on panic mode. That's
that's great. I think I'm also more similar to you. And I do have like great envy of people who can just take it one step at a time. We don't have to think about everything all at once. Just one thing at a time and we'll fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something that helps recently was like meditating. My partner meditates a lot. And so one thing that I started, like I tried it and it works sometimes. I'm just not the meditating type of person. Like I can't sit there for like 15 minutes. He does it for like an hour. I can't just sit there and like, I fall asleep. I would be napping. I wouldn't be meditating.
Look, I think if you do any meditating, that's great. So you know what? Congratulate yourself if you've done 10 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you.
And have you completed any courses that have inspired you?
So in my graduate studies at U of H, that's the school I went to, University of Houston, I took this course with a professor called Susan Rogers. And she's an expert in urbanism, urban planning, and mostly looking at like social impacts of design, as well as like how the inverse. So how design impacted society and how society can impact design. So it's her course that I took with her was the history of urbanism, mostly looking at like the North American context. And we were looking at like different decisions that were taken over time and how they impacted usually marginalized communities, whether it's like indigenous people or African-Americans, Latinos. And just sometimes some things were like shocking, but usually it's sadly like, one thing that I've learned to be that kind of disappoints me in education nowadays is that I do see like a very negative focus, even in the news. Like, I mean, all we ever hear is negative, negative, negative. We're not really taught anymore. Like, well, this was also done that was good. I know historically a lot of bad things have happened, but I feel like we do need a bit of a balance between like to give people hope, you know, like there are some positive things that came out of portions of our history. But her course was very enlightening, especially because I came from a background that I know nothing of North America. Like I know basics, you know, but learning more about urbanism and the history of urbanism in the US was interesting.
And I guess also, I mean, you would have learned how it applies in the North American context, but you probably could take it back to other countries and say, maybe this specific example doesn't apply here, but how else has the built environment affected communities or specific groups of people?
Mm-hmm. Well, because like Australia in many ways is probably very similar to the US because, you know, these ex-colonies that became their own nations, you know, they had specific tools that they used or that they learned from each other to develop themselves, but in return also oppress the people that were already there or marginalized communities. But now, like even anything that you learn maybe after like the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it all kind of blends into each other because what happens is like with globalism, with the global economy all being the same, now it's like more of a capitalism as like a vulture that the development kind of becomes similar everywhere. Like you see the discrepancies between poor and rich in every country. It's not just like in the developed world or in the underdeveloped, you know? So it kind of like all blends into each other, and what you learn in one place, you can easily like copy paste now elsewhere. Mm.
A good bad thing about globalism?
Well, you know, that is a globalism in many ways like has positives. And sure, that's what, you know, lots of people think. But at the same time, it does have a lot of dark things attributed to it. So, but that's the world. It's positives and negatives. And sometimes it's a lot more negatives than positives.
Yes. So I think we need to know what the negatives are, acknowledge them, but focus on the positives.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think we can't, like, one thing is, like, a negative personality, and I've seen this in my own life, like, if we focus too much on negative things all the time, then we don't think of solutions. So we need to be able to do both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So I like to start the podcast and the show by having a few definitions so we know what we're going to be talking about today. So the first thing I'd like to know is, how do you define home organization?
So I think in a broad like umbrella, it's basically like the science of how the user of a space finds efficient ways to use it. So how we're using space efficiently. And that differs from each and every individual. Even the people living in the same home, they all have different ways to use their home or their environment efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of that?
So me and my brothers, so I live currently with my two brothers, and I'm a control freak, but they're not. But the way that we each inhabit our own rooms, like you can see that, for example, my brother is a tennis player. His needs are very different because he has all these like large, you know, like he has his rackets, his tennis bag. He exercises a lot more than me. So he has like his duffel bag. So the way that he uses, for example, his tiny closet is very different than the way that I'm going to use it. I'm the type of person who like needs to have my clothes color coded. And I need to have, you know, like all the sweaters in the same place and all the button-up shirts in the same place. He doesn't care because he thinks in a different way, more efficiently for him. Like whatever he uses today, he just puts it to the front because he's always like moving them. And then everything else stays in the back. I can't because I need it to look pretty. So those are different needs. Who does it more efficiently is, you know, up to each person, I guess.
It reminds me of my partner and I. We have, as you said, we have very different closet habits. I have to fold everything, put everything in its special place so I know exactly where they are. He kind of just bundles everything up into roughly the right categories and shoves it in the closet. So he saves a lot of time with putting things away, but also he can never find anything. Whereas I spend a lot of time folding, but then I can always find things.
Yeah, that's kind of like me and my partner as well, because what happens is he doesn't wear as many clothes because he's a dentist, so he mostly wears his scrubs all the time. So he would just have like everything is in the back, and then he just has his scrubs and like, you know, like the essential daily needs. Versus me, I'm like, oh, every day, like I sit there in the closet and I'm like, what do I want to wear today? You know? So for him, that's like such a waste of time. But for me, I need to be able to see all my clothes because, you know, to be able to decide, I guess.
Mm. And I guess as well, because people will be looking at what you're wearing, was presumably they're not going to be looking at what he's wearing because a white coat is going over the top.
Yeah. So he doesn't. Recently, I think maybe it's my impact on him. He's been wearing clothes and then putting the coat on top. Like he's been wearing like, you know, a button up shirt and stuff like that. And I'm like, this doesn't look like you. Like something is wrong. But, you know,
Better or worse? Who can decide?
With it?
Yeah. And so I'd also like to know, what is a housing style, or what are housing styles?
So housing styles, like in a brief way that I think everyone can start to use to identify different houses, is looking at different architectural features that make the house what it is. And that comes in like two ways. Either the exterior of the building, just like looking at it, you can start to identify features of what you think it looks like, whether it's like a modern house, a postmodern house, or something that's more like, you know, like if we're just talking about the style of the house, it could be like, is it a townhome or a single family home? You know, like you can start with those categories. But if we're talking about like aesthetic styles, we're talking about like, is it a modern home? Is it maybe a Tudor style home or like an English country home? You know, those things, which you can easily tell from the outside if you just like have like a manual, especially in like North America or Australia, you can see like, it's almost like if you have a manual that shows you five houses and then you look at five houses that are different, you could still tell like, oh, this is this one. And this, you know, you can kind of relate them. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing that homes used to be more authentic in that you could help tell the style of is the interior. So like looking at like a floor plan, like seeing how are these rooms divided. Nowadays, most homes on the interior are like open floor plan, regardless mm-hmm. of what the house looks like from the outside. So that's kind of like, but in general, like the overall umbrella is looking at the identifying like architectural features, whether, and we can talk about that more.
Okay, yeah. So quite a few things I want to unpack there. I guess the first thing is, what are you, like, what are the defining features of different houses and different housing styles? Mm-hmm.
So the easiest thing anyone can look at is a roof. So the roof of the house, because a flat roof, you'll never see a flat roof on like an English cottage. Like, it just doesn't happen. Or and like in the northern portion of the US, like if we look at the Northeast, like if we're talking like New York or even Northwest, like Seattle or whatever, and anywhere with a cold environment where it snows a lot, you're rarely gonna see like a flat roof, at least traditionally. Modern technology, you can do it, it's easy. But traditionally, like you would see more of a cottage style home with a pitched roof, because for snow, you know, this, the weight of the snow would literally make the house collapse in the past. So like those are some of the identifying features, like the roof, what the exterior is, like before most homes, at least in North America, were brick, or if it was a wooden cottage, it's wood. But, you know, then we started using more like different materials or modern materials. So that's where like you can start to identify like the roof, the materials that the house is built in, the finishes of the house, which includes like how the windows are split up or all those different things. You can start to like piece together what this house means or what it is trying to tell you.
And do those different design features, you know, the pitched roof, brick instead of wood, are those chosen for aesthetic reasons, or are they more because of practical reasons? You know, the climate, as you said, with snow, or I don't know, what was available at the time? What are the reasons why we have different styles?
So there are multiple factors, kind of like clothing habits, like the styles changed over time. Things became popular, like something that you might see now and think it's like how now industrial style is, or like, you know, like retro or whatever is becoming popular now. You know, if 10 years ago you told people that you're going to be showing them the ductwork and the ceiling, people would have gone crazy. Like, what are you doing? Now it's popular. So some things come in trends, which is fine. But if we go back in time and we look at how those things started, it was almost always because of climatic reasons. So what the climate in the region is forcing people to design with, like I said, like, you know, snow or rain or whatever, any kind of thing that not falls from the sky, but you know what I mean? Like anything that could have a load on the roof, you can't design a flat roof with technology in the past, just because the load of it would cause the house to basically crash. If we're talking about like in North America, the reason why most houses are built of wood is because of the ease of the availability of wood. Mm-hmm. Where I come from, back in the Middle East, we don't have wood like people have here. So most of our homes were built with brick, well, not brick and mortar, but you know, concrete masonry units now and concrete in general. So here, we never built with steel, for example. Like all these different materials were varying based on region. And then the exterior of the house, like when we're talking about the finishes, now we have so many more options. But in the past, like if a house is just built of wood, like it's a cottage, then it's just, you know, you see the wooden exterior. People might build like with brick. It could be a full, like an authentic brick building would be just built with brick. But in some regions, you can't build with brick, either because it's not easily available or because brick isn't waterproof. So like in places where it rains a lot, ideally you don't want something that absorbs water. So it all varies based on region.
Okay. So I'm guessing that when you're, you know, maybe building a house, you have to think of those things because you don't want to, as you said, build a brick house where it rains a lot. I'm guessing that there probably aren't too many buildings that have already been built that aren't really designed for the environment, though. Like they wouldn't be particularly sought after, you know, if you bought a old flat roof house in a place with lots of snow, they wouldn't be very popular.
Well, so now with technologies now, most of the time, like these things are accounted for, you know, because you have professional engineers and you have, you know, architects don't sign off on something like that. Usually you need a professional engineer to tell you whether or not the house can sustain that load. But yeah, if it's a 200-year-old house, there's no way it's going to have a flat roof in like the Northeast. Like you're rarely going to see that. Or if it's a 300, because even to do that, it would be a lot more expensive and impractical versus like a regular pitched roof. But at the same time, like it's all trends, like what people are attracted to, because each age came with its different materials and, you know, things that people were attracted to.
Mm. Does that mean that nowadays with our technology and with, you know, just the different varieties of materials we have available to us now, does that mean people are designing houses with far more variety?
Yeah. Yeah, because now we have, like, for example, I live in Houston. Now, ideally, like, when we're building any project, a lot of our projects have, like, either brick veneer on the outside, which means just the shell on the outside is decorated with brick. Or, you know, like, if we are building with real brick, there are so many layers that you have to put in advance to make sure that your building is waterproof. But now, all this is easily available. It just changes the cost of your building and the time it takes to construct it. Obviously, like no one would recommend in a place like Houston, like to build a 5-story office building with all exterior brick. It just doesn't work and it's very expensive. But some people still want that and you can do that. It's not impossible. If you wanted to do something else, you know, like all the different kinds of varieties are easily available now.
Okay. So I guess it would be cheaper to work with your climate and with the environment and what's readily available.
Yeah, it always is. And it's always not just to construct, but also to maintain. Because as soon as you look at using a material that's not suitable for your environment, then you're looking at a lot of maintenance costs or life cycle costs.
Okay. All right. And so you also mentioned different types of houses, like single family homes, apartments. So do you mind explaining a little bit about the differences between those?
Okay. So like in Houston now, mostly like, or at least anywhere in, you know, English speaking countries, we can just put them all under one umbrella. Mostly what people want is a single family home. Like everyone just wants their home with, you know, like a garden and the picket fence and all those things. So that's the single family home. That's the idea of it. Then you had townhomes. Townhomes were like attached. Well, basically they just took the single family home, which could be one floor or two floors, two stories. And then they flipped it. And so they had like houses stacked vertically next to each other. And that became, well, the townhome. And it was a lot more popular in Europe. In the US, like, unless you're in the Northeast or any very dense city, no one likes townhomes. And Houston people like now are buying townhomes because it's like the alternative to having an apartment or getting like an attached condo. People don't like condos, but condos are basically, you know, like kind of like a step closer to apartments with the attached houses to one another. And then you jump to apartments, which are like you have you're part of one unit, basically, with multiple units.
Okay, sure. And I guess that would also impact how you live in there. So how do, you know, the different styles of the home and also the different, I guess, ways of having the homes, how do they impact how we live in the homes?
Well, it really depends on, so if it's like a single family home and it's a home that you own, you have so much freedom at least to inhabit that home however you like. In apartments, you have all these rules and it's always temporary. So the way that we inhabit a space when we know we're not there for 5 or 10 years is very different than how we inhabit a space, you know, in a year or, you know, so it's like, it's very different. But at least like, I remember when I was living in an apartment, I would like my apartment to be, you know, just like the space that I want to be in. So it didn't make a huge difference for me. But a lot of people, when they know like I'm moving out next year, they don't really inhabit that space the way they would usually, you know, have inhabited it otherwise, if that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. When I moved into my place 5 years ago, I thought we were only going to be there for a year. So there were a few things that we probably could have changed that we didn't. I mean, we're renting, so it's not like we can change a lot. But things like having the washing machine installed properly so that it's not just a hose we put in our sink. And I think if we had known that we were going to live there for 5 years, we would have done something much sooner about that situation. So I see where you're coming from in that, if you think you're only going to be somewhere for a year, you're probably not going to put the time and effort into putting up paintings, you know, painting walls. I also think when you're renting versus when you're buying a house, it also makes a difference because I'm like, I don't really care what carpet is in here as long as there is a carpet. The sliding door for the kitchen is fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, because rarely from my context, like you've been in an apartment for 5 years. And from what I've seen in my experience in Houston, that's rare. Like, you know, people are usually in their apartment maybe for 2 years and then they end up, you know, moving. And, you know, the idea that you have to move also makes you think a lot of what you want to buy and furnish your home with, because it's like, if I'm moving every year, I don't want to buy something that I really like that might break or get damaged while I'm moving. Or, you know, people are always like, when I buy a home, I'll get the furniture I really like. You know, like each person has a different thing, but that idea of like temporarily being in the space affects us all the same.
I do think it has affected, you know, the furniture that we've got, because I got most of my furniture secondhand off the side of the road and I haven't really upgraded it because it's like, well, it's fine. I don't expect to be here next year, and maybe next year I'll get some nice furniture. And then, you know, 5 years later, I still have the chairs from the side of the road.
But, you know, at least because you still use them. So it's like, in retrospect, you saved so much money, you know, because.
Oh, exactly. yes, I've furnished my home very, very cheaply.
Well, that was me. So like, you will never see someone buy a home and go furnish from IKEA, because everyone's like, oh, now I own a home. I need to like, at least here, like Crate and Barrel or whatever, like, you know, people who have the means. But for me, like when I went to furnish my apartment, it was like all either IKEA or like, you know, Facebook Marketplace or whatever, like you can get your hands on. But then like, even when I moved into my home, probably because of my background in design, so I was like, no, there are some things from IKEA that I really want for my home. Like, you know, I don't care if it's IKEA, like no one's going to know.
Yeah.
It's still a good brand.
I think that there are some things from IKEA, which I think are renting staples. And there are some things at IKEA that are actually good pieces of furniture that you actually want in your homes. And, you know, sometimes they overlap. I just think that IKEA is a very broad category.
Yeah, like one thing that I love in IKEA is their kitchens, because they're so simple and so cheap compared to like, of course, I've never bought a kitchen from IKEA, but I'm always like, well, if I do get the chance to tear down my kitchen and make a new one, I would make an IKEA kitchen, because they're very modern, very sleek. And usually to go to someone to custom make that, the price is times four. So I was like, oh, IKEA sounds like a good option.
My parents actually got an IKEA kitchen and they loved it.
Yeah. No, they're good. What I recommend to my friends always is like bedrooms from IKEA, because they're cheap and they last. And then like, if you want a really nice living room, I would probably like not get IKEA, because their couches aren't the best, like, or they're not the prettiest from my experience. But you know, just like, so like bedrooms always, like I furnished all three bedrooms from me and my brother and my other brother, all were IKEA. And then like the rest was different places.
Yes. Yeah. Good tips. So we have discussed a little bit about how different styles of home, they're affected by the climate and, you know, how those houses can affect us. But how, when we're, you know, looking at renting or buying a house, what should we be looking for? Like, how do we choose? Because I do assume that, you know, there are some differences, you know, depending on, you know, where you work, what kind of job you have. Also, you know, how big your family is, that affects what kind of houses you're buying.
Well, so when it comes to renting, I think in both cases, it's always location, location, location. Now, the parameters for those change because when you have a family, you know, it's about school district and safety more than when you're living in the, like me in the city. And I'm like, you know, I don't have kids, so who cares? And like safety, like it's unsafe everywhere. It's fine. So that's my living in the city experience. But usually what I think is more common is when people rent an apartment, they do pick it more suitably closer to their work versus when they buy a house, they almost forget where they work. Like I've seen people who commute an hour and a half for work every day. And I mean, an hour and a half one way, not even the way back. This is normal for Houston. Very normal. And I'm like, no, there's no way I could be able to do that. But usually what I think when people rent, they need to, at least in my experience, what I did was I got a space that I knew was close to my school because I didn't want to commute very far. And I also wanted a place that didn't necessarily look too, like wasn't necessarily the most expensive, most modern place, most modern finishes, because because people are definitely more willing to compromise when it comes to renting. Like, you know, like you said, like you compromise on the carpet or on the like paint or what, you know, you compromise on those things or the appliances. As soon as you live in a home, the list of compromises are very low, you know, mm-hmm. You're not going to compromise on like whether or not you want the new appliances because you're probably going to buy them yourself, you know? So that's kind of things that change, like people's willingness to, you know, compromise on things.
Mm. Yes. Back to my apartment. When I first moved in, I was shocked at the exterior. It was not where I thought I'd be living because I hadn't seen it before I moved in. And it's just this apartment block that looks kind of like it's falling down. But living there, it was actually fine. And as you said, the location was amazing. So yeah, that's the type of compromise that I was willing to make. But do you think that for renters, they always have to make that kind of compromise?
No, I mean, a lot of the times people find like the perfect place, like, and the place that they like. And some people, like the thing is with renting, sometimes you get lucky and you find the right place at the right time. But you know, when your lease is about to end in a month, you kind of have no choice but to be like, okay, I have to choose between these two. Versus when you're buying, you take your time. Well, before the pandemic, because things have changed, but before, you know, you take your time. Some people would, you know, like be looking to buy a house for a year. Nowadays, I mean, for a year, just choosing because they had choices and they could go and see all these different ones. Now, when we bought our home, it was like my parents flew in. It was like a 1 week period. We went and saw all the homes, and every time we'd go to a home, they're like, oh, but there are already three offers on this home. And it was a war to buy a home in, at least in Houston and probably everywhere. So, you know, that then at that time we had to compromise, like, because of this, it kind of became similar to when you're renting, because like you have to find a house in this time period. Otherwise it's gone. Like, there are no other choices, or interest rates are going to get hiked up. Kind of like what happened with apartments. Now it's kind of the same thing with houses. Like, you have no choice. Like, these are the houses available. You buy this or someone else is going to buy it.
Mm. So that would make it very difficult, I think, to find the dream place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It does make it more difficult.
Mm. Do you have any like suggestions on how people can, you know, improve their search? Obviously, I think it depends on circumstance, but what are things that people should be looking out for?
Well, so my parents, because, you know, they're more laid back and they don't know how the system works as well. I've only lived here a bit longer than them, so I kind of have an idea, but I'm also more tech savvy because, you know, they're my parents and they're older. but like, they wanted to rely solely on like what the realtor could get them. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. Lots of people just rely on their realtors. And our realtor was great. I loved her. But it's not the same as when you're looking for a house and you're really picking the parameters on like whatever Zillow or whatever app you're using to find a home. When you're actually like yourself looking, it makes a big difference. And do the research. Always, like, small tips are like, don't just look at the pictures that they posted of the house. Go on Google Street View. Even if it's not the same house, like, because if they updated the house, it's going to look a bit different in the pictures. The pictures would be more updated and always prettier. But, mm-hmm. you know, go on Google Street View. See what the neighborhood is like. Don't waste your time and go drive there and then realize, oh, crap, like, this is a dump. Like, we can't be here. You know, like, that happened with us a few times. Check online, like if you live in a city like Houston, make sure that you do your research on whether or not your house or the potential house that you're buying is in a floodplain, because we have flooding as an issue. Check, like, I don't know what else, like how close is it to other things? Not just like you can still be in the city in Houston, but be like 15 minutes away from a grocery store. I'm very lucky that I can walk to the grocery store, and I'm like, that's like 1% of the population in Houston can do that. So do that research yourself, because your realtor is not going to do that for you.
Mm. From my experience, the little paragraphs they give you on the websites are always like 15 minutes to the supermarket. But the supermarket they're talking about is some little convenience store that sells milk for twice the price as the supermarket.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, what supermarket is the close one? Just like you said, because like, let's say I found a nice apartment in downtown. Well, the closest supermarkets are probably going to be the really expensive ones that I'm never going to go to. And if it's in a not so great part of the neighborhood that I found this house or apartment in, then they're going to be the really bad, the really bad supermarkets that I'm never going to go to. So supermarkets are a big part of like where you live.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes, unfortunately. Well, fortunately. So we have spoken a little bit about renting, but what are some other challenges that renters face?
So I think these days it's affordability, mm-hmm. because people are definitely willing to pay more for a house, like on their mortgage. They're always, because the mortgage is a fixed price, you know, like that's a lie. It's not a fixed price. It increases every year because of taxes and so on. That's escrow. We can talk about that. But that's the big lie of mortgages and escrow and whatever. But when it comes to apartments, now with the current economy, we're seeing that markets are jumping up, like in places with no rent control, like most of the US, by 10%, 20%. And that's a lot. Like you can't every year, if you started renting for $1,200 in Houston, which is what I started at, it became $14,000. For the people who came after me, now it's 16, then it's 18,000 and it's 1800. And it's like, that's the struggle. Like you've stayed in an apartment for 5 years. Most people don't do that because then they just try to jump to another apartment that's a bit cheaper, but it's still more mm-hmm. expensive than what they were paying before. And then, you know, it becomes like this cycle every year. I know that my friends in Canada, for example, in Montreal, they've been in the same apartment for 5 years, but that's because they have rent control. And I know that that makes it, you know, the landlord can't just come and tell you, oh, I'm increasing rent 50%. But, mm-hmm. you know, so those are some things that are like problems with renting, like the affordability and the change in price. And, you know, that's one thing.
Yeah. We've had a similar situation in Australia where I've had friends who rent has gone up $100, $150 on something that was originally $300 to $400. That's a huge increase, you know, compared to what it was. I think that we have some like rental, measures, like the government controls. But I think that at the moment where because the whole market is changing, the real estate agents can say, well, this is what the market's doing, so we're going to do it anyway. So yeah, we're sort of in that in-between area, which makes it really hard for a lot of friends who are desperately looking for places. And they can't find anything that's in their budget.
Yeah. And you know, always like, I think everyone knows this. When you put like a budget that's like, oh, I'm going to look for an apartment for $500, you're going to end up getting the $600 one. So just always undershoot significantly, because then you'll kind of get to your budget.
Yeah. Okay. So you know you've got $500 you can spend. Say you've got $400.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's no way, like, for us, for example, like our budget, when we were buying a home was the same thing. Like our budget, let's say it was $400,000 in the city. Yes, we could have bought a house for maybe $250 if it was an hour away, but we, like, my priority was like being close to human beings and to civilization. I wasn't going to live all the way out in the suburbs. But you know, like still, like you end up, when you put your budget as $400,000, Zillow or whatever other app you're using, HAR or whatever for finding homes, they're going to show you the $450 and the $550. And then you're going to end up like looking and being like, oh, I wish I could afford this. And then you end up having to buy something above your budget. So always undershoot, always.
Mm. So it's about, and what you're saying is it's also about your priorities. So figure out what your priorities are. So whether or not you want a bigger house further away or a smaller house, a bit more expensive, a bit smaller maybe.
Yeah, because you're going to start to have to compromise on your different needs. Like me living in the city means that in the specific place where I live, I can walk to the grocery store, to the bank, to a few restaurants, which I know I would never have the luxury of if I lived in the suburbs.
And I guess you do save a bit of money in terms of like petrol costs if you live in the city.
Yeah, because I have my uncle, for example, he commutes from the suburbs every day to work. He takes an hour. It's an hour drive for him. And you know, I told them, like, I know you're saving on your mortgage or your house payments, but when you actually start to look at gas and how much your car is depreciating because of the distance you're driving and how much you're having to fix it because of, you know, changing tires and all those things, you're paying the same amount as me at the end of the day. Like, we're paying the same amount. Now, granted, the lifestyle that they want, that house accommodates them because they want the big backyard. They want the quiet and, you know, no police sirens. I'm fine with you know, it depends really on where you live, but I'm fine with hearing the occasional ambulance. Like, it's okay. You know, it's part of the city noise.
I stayed at my dad's house in the country this year, and I was shocked at how quiet it was. It was eerie.
Yeah, it becomes like a cultural shock, and like, you're like, why is it so quiet? Like, I need noise. Like, you start looking for the noise.
Yes, exactly. Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about in the interview?
Well, if we're still going to talk about like homes and stuff, and how you know, at least consumer patterns are changing when it comes to people buying or people renting, I think one thing that I saw on the podcast, you had interviewed someone else before, and he was talking about how homes are becoming more of a commodity than it is like an essential like human right. When we look at that topic specifically, we see that all this like culture, and I've had a lot of talks about with my boyfriend, not with like experts, but we've had these conversations about the commodification of housing, and it's become like our investment culture. Like, I have a home and I can afford it, but I'm going to buy another one. Why? Because I want to rent it out as an Airbnb. We're not thinking of how we're screwing over everyone else. We're just thinking, you know, this is an investment that suits me and that helps me make more money. And while that's fine in some aspects for the individual, it is for the greater good of society. It is detrimental. Like, as long as we think of homes as like these pieces that we purchase, you know, there's a lot of studies about this in London, in Toronto, in Melbourne, where not even like people, for example, not just like individuals, like that's a small scale, like of me buying another home, for example, but these large banks or these large, you know, like I think it was maybe 50% or some number, I'm not going to give a specific number, but a large portion of property that's vacant, but owned by someone in London is owned by Qatar. Like, they purchase properties abroad as just, you know, that's kind of how they maintain their investment and their money. But like, at the same time, London has one of the biggest housing crises in the world. Same with Toronto. Like, people just buy buildings and they keep them because that's like their asset. It's like gold in the bank, or like, you know, like you're buying gold bullion. Well, I'm just going to buy this tower. I don't have to rent it out to anyone because it's an asset. I don't want, like, I don't need the money. I'm just buying it because I have the money. So it's kind of, that's what's kind of becoming detrimental to our housing crisis. That's what's causing the housing crisis these days. That's one of the factors, at least.
Yeah. I've seen that in Melbourne, especially, that, you know, people buy these investment properties and then, as you said, they sit empty. And, but, you know, whereas we have at the moment a bit of a rental crisis where people need places to live, people have, and people want to buy houses, but they can't. So then they have to rent. And so you have all these people stuck in the rental market who want to buy, but they can't. Because you have all these people who are buying investment properties. But I guess, how can we, is there a way that we can change that situation? Just build more houses?
Well, we can keep building more houses, but someone's going to end up coming and buying them for an investment. And the thing is, now with current supply chains, we don't have at least the resources and the time to like solve the problem by just like building more. And especially in like cities like Houston, like one of our problems isn't that we don't have space. We're actually 2 million people live in Houston versus the, let's say, and we occupy a footprint that's like 10 times the size of Paris, which has the same number of people. That's because of people's like unwillingness to change their like living habits. Like, everyone wants a single family home, and it's like, this isn't sustainable. Like, where are we going to keep building single family homes? Like, we already, like, if you look at like Houston, Austin, and Dallas, they call that the Texas Triangle, and San Antonio. Already these cities are almost connected, and they're like probably the size of, I don't know what state or what country, like that's how big they are. And they're connected because it's just sprawl and sprawl, because everyone wants a piece of that, you know, single family home life. But that just doesn't work. Like, you can't keep building single family homes. People need to live in apartment buildings. People need to live in condos or townhomes because those are more compact. So that's one solution, is becoming more compact. And those are cheaper solutions at the end of the day. Like, people can afford them more, but people aren't willing to sacrifice when they can buy a single family home. That's one thing. The second thing is, I think it's a cultural change. Like, we need to also change our ideas on investment in property, because it, or at least prevent, I don't know how you would prevent, like, I don't know, like Chevron or Shell or ExxonMobil from buying half the city and saying, oh, this is our investment, you know? I don't know how you do that. I don't think there is any way to do that. But at least on an individual level, if we start to think, well, maybe I can invest in something other than something that other people need, like a house to live in, or at least if I do, like, let me rent it out at a reasonable price and not say this is a $10,000 a night rental, you know, like those small things. People need to just be more human and less like bankers, I guess. No offense to bankers, but
yeah. I do have a bone to pick with people who have more than like maybe one or two rentals. I think that rentals are, people need to rent. Like, not everyone can buy immediately. There are always people who are going to need to rent. So I don't have a personally have a problem with people who have like one or two rental properties. But any more than that, it's like, what are you trying to do? Or people who buy a house and flip it and then sell it for more money. Mm-hmm. Is that a big problem, do you think?
It is a big problem. What's happened, and that's part of gentrification. There are like one thing, and I always forget the name of this documentary, but I think it was like a European agency that did it. I don't remember, but they did the documentary that I was telling you about like London, Toronto, and different cities. And how everything is becoming like, people are investing in properties, not thinking of it as a human right. But you have companies like the big, scary, like finance companies, like BlackRock, I think that's what they're called, that everyone's afraid of. They buy like whole apartment complexes and they just sleep on them and they wait. Maybe they don't rent them out to anyone. They wait till they evict everyone or till everyone's lease is up. Either they tear it down and build this like luxury apartment, or they keep it as like part of their portfolio. But like, instead of letting people who could afford it before live there, they don't want to. They don't, it's not part of their, you know, long-term goals. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to people renting multiple properties or buying multiple properties to rent them out, like in Houston, what we're seeing, for example, is lots of people like go and they buy torn down homes or empty lots in poor neighborhoods. And then they build like, you know, 6 townhomes on that lot and they sell each one for like $500,000. So what happens is like those people live on like that tiny island of townhomes, like knowing that it's a poor neighborhood. They're going to see more crime just because of generally like poverty and crime are correlated. So they live in their own gated tiny community, but these communities start to pop up kind of like mushrooms all over like poor neighborhoods. Now, let's say that someone was living there and they could afford living there in their own like old home from whatever year, 1950s, and they were living there and they live paycheck to paycheck. What happens here is the next year, because of all these new properties that were sold for like $500,000 each, your property now is more expensive because everyone around you is more expensive. So naturally, your property is in higher demand. Even if you own it, it's still appraised at a higher value. What happens then is your taxes, instead of being like $5,000 a year, now your taxes are $20,000 a year. And you live off of the same paycheck. And It only increased because your property value increased. That's a problem we're having in Houston. So people have to sell their homes and move even if they owned it and they don't even have a mortgage. That's what happens. But if you're renting at the same time, if I own a property and I'm renting it out for $500 a month in Houston, and then all these townhomes are getting built around me and someone is looking to buy my property, of course I'm going to sell it and then let someone build something more expensive. Like financially, it's silly for me to be renting it out still, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what kind of how gentrification is changing poorer neighborhoods in Houston. And then no one asks the question of like, where are these people going to live? Like these people who are getting kicked out of their neighborhoods, where are they going to go? Mm. And then it just spreads because ultimately it's like kind of the survival of the fittest, who can afford the most. And then the market like resolves it, but no one thinks of the.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean we should stop gentrification? We should stop people from buying, blocks of land or old houses in poorer areas and stop developing them? Or is there a different way to go about fixing this problem?
So no one has a solution, like a black and white solution. Like some cities have tried, like, for example, like giving certain status to properties. Like let's say I own a property and all this is happening around me. Like in certain instances, they lock in your taxes and they're like, okay, fine. Like we won't, your property will keep getting appraised at a higher value, but your property taxes will be locked on to what you're paying now. But it's only for localized regions. Like they're piloting this in small areas. So that way, like if I own my property and I can't pay more in property taxes, then I can stay because even though everything around me is getting more expensive, I am still paying what I used to pay 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Another mechanism is like they're designating neighborhoods as historic districts or they're, But what that does is historic districts start to have rules. Like you can't change a window unless it's a specific window because it has to maintain, you know, how the historic district looks like. That also pushes up prices of property because now it's like a special neighborhood. Or like some other mechanisms people have been trying to use are like to prevent people from buying properties and building townhomes on them. They're like, if the property is a certain size, you can't chop it up and build multiple homes on it. So then it makes it it doesn't incentivize like a developer to come and buy out like, you know, 5 properties, combine them together and build like 50 homes. So, you know, they're trying all different things. I don't think there will ever be like a black and white solution. But I guess we'll see. I mean, it doesn't look good so far, but we'll see what happens.
I guess the thing is to be aware of what is happening so that, at least you can be cognizant of what is happening and try and make meshes to change things or not to affect things so much. So we'll move on to the practice and habits section next. So what is something that you do in your own home to manage your impact on your home and environment?
So small things I do are like regular maintenance and cleaning. Always trying to add equity to my home by doing slight modifications here and there. I know everyone thinks, okay, like we all clean. And yes, we do all clean. Maybe some people don't clean, but like we all should have the habit of making sure our home is clean. And the reason is that helps everything in your home last longer. So you don't have to change things out as often. That's a small reason why. Plus, if you don't have bugs, then like if I saw like a lot of bugs in my house, I'm moving out. I'm not staying there. I'm not living with any bugs. But regular maintenance could be like always whenever like you have to change a light bulb. Don't just change the one light bulb and have the color of all the light bulbs look different. No, go ahead, make the initiative to get the slightly more expensive like LED bulbs. It'll lower your energy bills. It will make your space more pleasant. Or, you know, like things that I've done are like, I always recommend like to my neighbor, for example, she was looking at doing a home renovation and she tried to replace the stucco on the outside of her home because there was some stucco damage. And the quote that she got was like $40,000. And I was like, wait, hold up, Stephanie. Like, I understand that you want this, but is it a want or a need? Because if you replace that stucco and repaint your house, it's not adding $40,000 to your home value. Like you can't sell that idea off. Like, so you have to start to think of what can I do to my house that will maintain its property value or increase it a bit, or just keep my equity like in place. I added solar panels to my home, for example. Like I saw like 7 different companies before I made the decision, but I thought like, okay, how is this going to add equity to my home? What are the possible tax rebates? Like there are so many parameters that go into this. Someone wanted to give me a quote on changing windows. And I was like, no, because I'm not paying $40,000 to change my windows. That's not doing anything for, it's not giving me my money's worth, you know? So those small things here and there.
But sort of making these changes to improve the equity of your house, doesn't this feed into the commodification of property?
Well, yes. But the thing is, when you're living in your own home, you want it to, at least I'm not like, so what happens, what makes it worse is when someone, for example, comes in and decides like, I'm going to tear down the house and build something ultra modern and sell it for like 3 times the value. But when you're doing slight modifications to your own home, it will increase your property value and it might negatively impact other people. But it also depends on like where you live. So if you live in a neighborhood that's generally middle class and you come in and you do small tweaks to your home, you're not negatively impacting anyone. And generally everyone likes that you're increasing your property value. But if you're in a poor neighborhood and then you go and do that, like I build a $10 million home in the middle of like an island of people with lower economic means, I'm screwing all of them over, you know?
Okay.
So it's like, yes, we are hypocrites in a certain way. And that's just, yes, that's my short answer.
Okay. But I guess there's also the difference as well. You were saying you put solar panels on, and I'm sure part of it improved the equity, but also I'm sure it improved your electricity bill.
Yes, it did. Not by a huge amount because the system is rigged to always get you broke. That's just how America works. I've learned over the years.
Yep.
But like at the same time, and I know there are so many people who are going to be like, but solar panels are actually bad for the environment and so on. And yes, I'm just trying to lower my carbon. Like I'm trying to offset my carbon. I know that the solar panels are not necessarily ethically sourced. There's a problem everywhere. Everything has pros and cons, but you know, it was just a choice that I made.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess you have to, I guess, weigh all these factors together. When you're trying to, you know, make do maintenance or make improvements on your home, like, is it a want or a need? You know, is it going to improve my life? Is it going to improve equity? Is it going to disadvantage anyone else?
Mm-hmm. And like, you wouldn't, like, for example, if you're making a decision on solar panels, a small example, like you don't put new solar panels on an old home that's more than like 30 years old that still has an old roof, because you're going to have to tear down that roof at some point and rebuild or like do major roof repairs if your house is like 30 or 40 years old. So like, you know, you have to take these things into consideration. The home we purchased was just 14 years old. So I know the roof has another 10, 20 years on it. So it's about the same time that the solar panels will survive for. So, you know, like you have to weigh the investment along with like the life cycle of that investment and how long you want to live in a home. You're not going to put solar panels on a home you're going to be in for 2 years, you know?
Okay. So, you know, regular cleaning, maintenance, and, you know, improving the equity of your home. What are some good things about this practice?
So first of all, like, I would say happiness. I find pleasure in, like, I'm not one of those, like, extreme gardening folks, but I now find pleasure because I know it's my garden, you know, like, and I like seeing the flowers bloom, and, you know, those small things. But also, like, other than equity and it helps with, like, your ability to sell the home again. So let's say I wanted to sell my home. No one's going to buy it, or people might buy it if it's not as updated as other homes. Like, you need to keep your house competitive in the market. But what happens is, if it's not as competitive, people will always counteroffer at a lower price. And people will be like, no, we won't buy your house for this value unless you give us this discount and this discount and this discount so that we can make these fixes. So always keeping your house aesthetically nice and kind of appealing is important, because otherwise you're going to have a harder time selling your home or renting it if you're keeping it as an investment property.
And are there any challenges to, you know, making these improvements or like regular cleaning and maintenance? I know a challenge for me is the fact that I don't want to do it.
Well, yeah. Well, when it comes to cleaning, I'm the same kind of, like, I like my house clean, but, like, when you come back from work and then you have to study, for example, or something as well, like, the likelihood that you're going to clean is very low. But what I do is I have a cleaning lady come every 2-3 weeks, because, you know, and this way, like, we split the bill, my brothers and we make sure that the house is, like, thoroughly cleaned every 3 weeks, you know, other than our regular, like, vacuuming. But the other challenge is money, because those things are expensive. Like, always putting in equity into your home means always spending money. But that's why you, like, do your research, because there's so many mechanisms, so many loans that are not, like, predatory loans, like 10, 20% interest. Some companies offer, like, you know, 1 year of no interest and then you start paying. So, you know, finding those good deals that, you know, you can pay off ASAP that won't cause you, like, a financial burden.
And I know in Australia, sometimes the government will actually subsidize some of it. So I know that I think either now or just quite recently, solar panels were subsidized. So if you wanted to make that improvement to your home, it was a lot cheaper. And of course, anyone who has a home that they own should, of course, do that, because why not? So yeah, doing that research and finding out what your government, your local council is providing for you.
Yeah, in the US, we have the same thing. They give a tax rebate for anyone who's buying solar panels. Different states have different rules because it's the US. So, like, California incentivizes it even further with, like, state tax rebates. In Texas, we only have federal rebates. But that's also another important point, because people also then have to, like, because a lot of people think of rebates, like, on electric cars, they also have rebates on them. But people need to do their research, because, like, electric cars, I learned that the rebates on those only work for 1 year. So let's say you're supposed to get $7,000 back from the government, but you've only paid $2,000 in taxes. You only get $2,000 back. That $5,000 disappears. Solar panels, which I discovered happily, and I hope that it stays this way, and I hope I'm right, I'm not wrong, and the tax guy tells me I'm wrong. But the way that the solar panel rebate works is that it carries over from year to year. So if you're supposed to get $10,000 back and you only got $2,000 this year, you still have $8,000 that you're supposed to get the year after from the government. So I was like, okay, that's fine. Like, it's splitting it up. I don't think I'm paying $10,000 in taxes this year. I just don't make that much money. But yeah, so, like, you know, doing that research is important too.
Mm-hmm. All right. And should everyone, you know, think about improving their homes?
I think so. Unless you're, like, only planning, like, if you're renting, I wouldn't put too much investment into a home unless you're staying there for a long time, like you are. Because, like, a lot of people don't want to put holes in the wall because they know then they have to do so many things to get their security deposit or whatever. But if you're in an apartment for 5 years, it's not as problematic for you because, you know, you have all that time. But if you're only looking to live in a home for like 2 years and you're going to sell it again, I wouldn't put too much investment because it's time consuming. It's costly and you're not going to see the returns in 2 years.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Do you have any other recommendations or you're all recommended out?
I think I gave too many recommendations today, but I think, just do, you know, at the end of the day, if it's your home or your apartment, just do the things that you know you'll enjoy, regardless, because everyone has different opinions and there are so many ways you can go wrong or you can go right. So just enjoy it and, you know, and enjoy your life, basically, because that's most of your life in an apartment or a home.
At the end of the day, we're living there. We're not just, you know, it's not just an investment. It's where we live.
Especially if you work from home, because then you're basically there like at least 22 hours of the day.
Yeah, that sounds like me. Thank you so much for talking to me today. If our listeners want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
So they can find me on LinkedIn. I won't spell out my name because that'll take 30 minutes, but I can share that information with you. But it's my name. It's Tariq Mubayed. Yeah, mostly LinkedIn, I think, would be a good resource.
Great, thank you. And we'll put that in our show notes so people can find you without having to spell your name.
Yes.
We'll also put the link in for the or the name of the paper that you were talking about, if you could send that to me. And also the podcast that you were going to suggest. We'll put those all in the show notes so everyone can find them.
Okay, great.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Room by Room, produced by the Home Organization Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes like this from across 10 life management perspectives can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your smart devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at ho.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Gabriella Yastra. Thanks for tuning in.